Well, we were just discussing, B.F. Skinner. And I'm very serious when I tell you that I think one of the reasons why Skinner became so popular was simply that psychology was looking for a theory that it could experimentally study. And clinical psychologists were having difficulty. I mean, the studies of psychoanalytic concepts, the studies of Rogerian concepts, of Maslowian concepts, were very difficult. And as a result, we went from the profound to the utterly simplistic. But we could study the utterly simplistic. And we didn't spend a lot of time as clinical psychologists actually in that phase. Some did. But there really was an evolution. And the evolution became that even when doing what we might call behavioral interventions, we still realized that there were certain interventions that required us to use someone's internal life. So we moved through and developed, first of all, what we call behavior therapy. And behavior therapy started with the premise that you can alter a person's psychological state by, first of all, determining their symptoms, then using specific behavioral interventions, and in many cases, you actually created new experiences for people. Now, the most noted strictly behavioral intervention, and it isn't strictly behavioral, but it's one that is often seen that way, is progressive relaxation. And this particular intervention, which I'll describe to you, was especially helpful in certain areas like phobias, but only with phobias, for instance, where someone had a great fear of giving a speech. It wasn't nearly so effective in some of the clinical phobias, but you could have, if you had a reasonably healthy person and the person had a great fear of giving a speech, then progressive relaxation worked very well. And what the treatment was is that you had a person lie down. And first of all, of course, they identified, like, what is the problem? So let's say giving a speech is their problem. And they're terrified, getting in front of an audience. This is a serious difficulty for this person. So you've identified something they want to overcome. And you have them tell you about all the fears they have. And then you start building a hierarchy back to things that are safe. So, or you might start with something very safe and work up. Let's say the issue here is to get someone in a totally relaxed state. So you might start by having them imagine that they're lying on a warm beach with their eyes closed and the sun is gently, shining. There's a soft breeze blowing and they're feeling very, very relaxed. And then you have them, go from there to having a solitary walk on the beach that they find very, very comfortable and they like, and then they eventually get in their car and they drive home, and then they start getting ready for their speech. And probably at that point they begin to experience some anxiety. And then they work more on their speech, and eventually they get to the place they're going to give their speech, anxiety is much higher. And then they're eventually going to have to step out and stand before an audience, and the anxiety is the highest. So what you do is you're going to try to teach the person how to be as relaxed when you're standing in front of that audience as you would be if you were lying on that lovely beach. So you start by having the person lie down, and you have them go through the various muscle parts in their body and relax their muscles. And so you can start, if you want, with their hands, and you have them, clench their hand and then release it and let them experience how their hand feels very relaxed. And then you do their forearm, and you do your biceps, and you do your shoulders, and you keep having the person tense that part of their body and then relax it till eventually you've gone through the whole body and the person is just lying there and they're really at peace. And you've predetermined this series of experiences they're going to go through. So then you have them imagine they're on the beach and they're feeling very relaxed. And then you take them through the next things. And when they get to the first item on their list that creates anxiety, they put their hand up, that as soon as they begin to feel anxiety. And you take them back to the step before that, and you get them relaxed again so that they're feeling completely relaxed. And then you try to move them to the next step where they can actually experience, let's say, driving home and thinking about their speech without getting anxious. And then maybe you go to the next step where they're at home working on the speech and they get anxious. You have them go back and you imagine that they were driving home. And you go through these stages until you get the person to the point where they can really experience lying there, realize they're right in front of that audience, and they're absolutely calm. Now, you might think that, well, you know, that's one thing to say, you get somebody like that in your office, but what about when they get up in front of all those people? Well, amazingly enough, this works. That, you know, people really do, really are able to overcome, let's say, a phobia for giving a talk by going through this process. However, as you can see, we have already moved away from, in some ways, what Skinner was focused on, which is only behavior. Because in order for this technique to work, you have to use a lot of internal processes. You've got to think about giving the talk. You've got to be reflective. But this was a lot closer to basic science than were people who are trying to study the degree of empathy that a Rogerian therapist had towards his or her client. So this became very popular for a while. Now, this treatment, by the way, I should mention, often is seen as having been started by a man named Joseph Wolpe. Joseph Wolpe is certainly one of the founders of behavior therapy, and people often talk about him. Joseph Wolpe was a psychiatrist trained in South Africa. And one of the things Wolpe always did, I was always struck by this, when Wolpe would get up, he was talking to psychologists, he would say, I want to say that while I have an MD, it's a real doctorate. I did a doctoral dissertation, because in South Africa, to get a doctoral degree in medicine, you had to do a dissertation. So Wolpe very much identified with the scientist part of the psychologists, and so he was extremely popular with psychologists. However, he wasn't really the first person to start this process. Actually, earlier, a man named Edmund Jacobson, and there are a lot of books out. Jacobson wrote all kinds of books. Edmund Jacobson also was a physician with a PhD in physiology. And what was really interesting with Jacobson was that Jacobson was actually an internist in private practice in downtown Chicago. And he spent his whole career that way. He spent some time at the University of Chicago on the faculty, but mostly he was in private practice. And he developed techniques when he saw people just coming in to his general practice. And so he began developing the system of relaxation. And he wrote a book detailing it, giving significant detail really about it. And he did some research right in his office. And he became the real proposer of using relaxation as a way to overcome a lot of problems. Now, he used it not only, let's say, to overcome phobias like we just described, but he found it was very effective in helping people who had headaches. He even found it was effective in helping people where he had determined by physical exam that whatever this person's upset about, I can't find anything physically wrong. If I can teach them to relax more, maybe these symptoms will go away. And then he wrote about it. And indeed, that's just what happened. Now, we're going to move to what really is more the modern state of things, and that's cognitive behavioral therapy. And what happened was that when people began seeing that you just can't really work with the limitations of Skinner, And to be honest, the clinical world, the real clinical world, that is those people who worked in hospitals and outpatient clinics and that, never really spent much time paying attention to Skinner. I mean, that never became a popular mode of treatment amongst most of the treatment people. People were still much more focused on the treatments that they had learned from the psychodynamic school and from the client-centered school and the existentialist school. But there were psychologists who were trying to see, can we define better what it is we do so that we can more experimentally investigate it? So a man named Julian Roeder came along. And let me see if I can. And Roeder. Started. Can you see that? Oh, I have to push black. Okay. Well, then I didn't get rid of this. Thank you, Scott. Okay, can you see this? Okay, Julian Roeder. Julian Roeder was a clinical psychologist, but he's trained very experimentally, trained at Iowa. And what he did is he brought cognition in as a variable in behaviorism and created really this cognitive behavioral model. But he did things that really were very different than what had previously been done. For example, he posited that history is unimportant. You don't need to know why somebody is anxious in order to deal with their anxiety. You don't need to focus on all kinds of issues that may have gone on for, you know, years ago. He felt those things were unreliable, and he thought that therapy took too long. And so he started off with the premise, find out what the person's problem is. So the person feels that they're not being effective in interpersonal relationships. He felt that actually that's probably the most common thing that people come into therapy for. And what he believed was that experiences and interpersonal interactions constantly influence one another. That is, what you have experienced up until now will have an effect on what you're about to do. But you don't have to go back and explore all those experiences to kind of figure out what the person's problem was. So the key concept in Roeder's theory became reinforcement. But what was different, you know, you might say, well, that's what Skinner's key concept was. But the difference with Roeder was that he was interested in expectancies. That is, he was interested in the internal life of the person. What was the person expecting to have happen? And he was interested in socially what happens to the person when they try to achieve their ends. He would look at things and see, well, you know, here's a person that does things for someone important so that they will like them. So he would see, okay, we can see what the expectations are. This person wants to be liked. They've identified somebody as important, and they want the person to like them. So what do they do? Well, maybe they invite this person over, and they make a delicious meal for the person. And they want, you know, the person to feel very good about it. It's a very nice environment. They've done something for this person. The person should like them, etc. But he began to realize that things can go wrong even when you do something that on the surface appears very nice if you don't appreciate the environment in which it is occurring. So, for example, let's say you're trying to appeal to somebody that you want to date. You invite the person over. You've made a good choice, perhaps, too. A very nice person. And the person comes over. You said you're going to cook a meal. You surprise them. Perhaps you're actually quite talented as a cook. And you put on this wonderful meal. The problem is that it's a rich meal because you happen to like, say, French cooking, Italian cooking. You're very good at it. And you've invited over somebody who's on a diet, and you didn't know that. So all of a sudden, the environment that one would seem to think superficially is just great for these two people isn't good, because you've got one person who's putting tremendous energy into something in the relationship, but they're missing that's not the thing to do at this particular time, so they're not going to get rewarded. And what Roeder would concentrate on is to get the person to understand that you have to know something about the other person's reward system. For instance, had you cooked some light meal that was low in calories but very tasty, the other person, and you actually told the person, by the way, this is very low in calories, this person might felt great about being at your place, rather than realizing they're facing a very high calorie meal, something they've been trying to avoid all along. So the environment that they're in is not a desirable one. And so what he said is that you need to know what would be the reinforcement system, the positive reinforcement system for people, in order to make this work. Then he also said that he thought parents were very important models, and that in some ways the way in which you learned to behave and to relate to others is you learn from models. So parents and other significant people actually probably have had a big influence on why you behave in the particular way you do. So you may want to know a little bit about what were the models that someone was exposed to, because that may tell you why they're doing certain things. And as the therapist, you want to listen carefully to what this person learned, because if you hear that they're modeling certain things that are not good for them or not good for other people, then that's what's going to be the focus of therapy. Now, you know, it's interesting. This is a fairly simple observation to make. But if you think about it, we have often talked about the fact that, for instance, people, men who are wife beaters have often had fathers who were wife beaters. And now that's not always the case. And if someone's father was a cruel person and punished one's mother, doesn't mean you're going to be that way. But we do find in any number of cases that somebody who is that way actually learned that from observing behavior in the family. Well, that's a tremendously important thing to know, that the model that someone had growing up actually dealt with his anger by taking it out on a woman. So later on, when somebody gets very angry and they don't know what to do, and the only model they've had for how you deal with your anger is you hit someone, they start doing it. And in this theory, what you would do is, once you found out that really this person grew up in that kind of environment, you would immediately get the person to start talking about what are alternatives. What other behaviors did you ever consider besides hitting somebody? And what Roeder would say is, it's not going to take you that long. After all, the person has come in, the person's in great danger of perhaps losing a spouse, maybe in great danger of going to jail, maybe in danger of losing a job. So there are lots of reinforcements that are going to be lost if this person doesn't change. And so what you do is you don't spend a lot of time talking to him about his father. That Roeder would say that's a waste of time. Talk to him about alternative behaviors, and talk to him about how he can listen to himself, internally recognize that he's getting angry, and then think about other ways to express that anger rather than to begin hitting someone. Now, Roeder's theory is much more complicated than I presented to you, but I'm going to move along because we can't cover all these people. But I want to give you a feeling for how things changed in psychology. Now, I certainly want to point out to you that everything we've talked about up to now is still going on. That is, there's a whole psychodynamic school and a whole client-centered school and interpersonal school, existential school, etc., still very active in psychology. But there have been advances, and the cognitive behavioral is the newest. Now, Albert Bandura then came along. And, let's see. Oh, I just remembered I'm supposed to hit pen here, I think. Well, Scott, I don't know why this... Oh, maybe that's erase. No? Scott, why won't this thing erase? After I took my lessons about how to do this, aha. Aha, I've discovered it. Okay. No. Okay, Albert Bandura comes along. And Albert Bandura, again, was another clinical psychologist. Actually, Bandura got his degree at Iowa, as did Roeder. But he came along a number of years later. And he introduced a concept that's called triadic reciprocal determinism. Triadic Okay, triadic reciprocal determinism. And what this involved were three things, obviously. It's triadic. Cognitive and interpersonal factors, he felt, were very important. He felt you really do want to know what is the behavior of a person. And then you want to know what other environmental influences are interacting with each other that are causing this person to be the way he or she is. So you've got these kind of cognitive factors and personal factors. Some of them would be historical. You've got the person's actual behavior, which is definitely going to be the focus. But you do want to understand other environmental influences that are interacting both on this person and with each other. And in this model, then, we are going to focus on behavior. Now, he would say that in terms of our environment, what's important is that everybody appraises their environment. That is, everybody gives some meaning to their environment. And we act in an environment. And then we experience the consequences of the environment. You know, one example might be, you're in an environment, two women go to a party. They're both standing, see a man come through the door. One woman says, "Boy, that guy really has a nice smile." The other woman says, "No, it seems to me, he really has a smirk." Okay? Now think about this. It's the same behavior. It's the same observation. That is, there's one guy walking through the door. Whatever he is doing, one woman sees it as an approach kind of behavior, as this is a nice person, this person has a nice smile, this person, and so you would attribute desirable things. The other person sees him as having a smirk, like maybe he's kind of a smart aleck, he's aloof, he's not desirable, let's not waste our time trying to get to know him. Very, very different kind of experience. And what Bandura, would say is that this is why you have to know kind of the way someone thinks. This is why you have to know a little bit of the background of people and how they see their environment, because one person, our first woman, is much more open to her environment. I mean, given that someone has just walked in the door and he's a stranger, her first response is very positive. I mean, she sees good things in him. You do wonder then about the second woman, very cautious, is even told by her good friend that this guy looks like a friendly guy, and she immediately says no. So, her expectations, for instance, at this party are probably pretty low. And if you were to be able to test the anxiety in these two women at the party, you would probably find that the anxiety of the first woman is very low. that she's feeling fine. The anxiety of the second woman, especially with the threat of having to meet new people, is probably pretty high. So Bandura would say, once you know this, then you know how you can move forward in trying to help someone, because you realize that they appraise the environment as being hostile. And he developed what we call social learning theory. And he also proposed that modeling really plays a very big role in how we learn. And he felt that modeling plays a big role in childhood, but modeling plays a big role in adulthood also. And so he felt if modeling is important, then if you're going to be a therapist, you also need to be a model. That is, if you had our second woman we just described in therapy, then you would want to try to model for her that that you are a warm, caring person, that she's safe with you, she's never going to get put down by you, that you're going to allow her to talk about the anxieties that she has and the fears that she has. But the difference in cognitive behavioral therapy is you don't let the person spend a lot of time doing that. What you do is you try to get a sense of what is the problem, and then you begin developing strategies for how might the person deal with these social scenes so that they feel safer and better and things work for them. Now, we're then going to go on and talk more about what treatment is like and how treatment kind of interacts with science and treatment interacts with theory. I also should mention that there are many cognitive behavioral therapies. So you want to be aware that every thing I talk about is not like the cognitive behavioral therapy. There are lots of strategies that have been developed, but they all kind of fall under this rubric. The same way that in psychoanalysis, there are actually a lot of different therapies in that. As you know, some are the orthodox analysis where the analyst would actually sit behind the patient. That's very different than other forms of psychoanalysis where the analyst sits right with the patient and is highly interactive with the person. You'll find the same thing is true in cognitive therapy. Now, there are three fundamental premises that I want you to be aware of with cognitive therapy. And this underlies pretty much all of the therapies. One is that cognitive activity affects behavior. Very different than Skinner. You know, one premise that came along with Roeder and Bandura was what you are thinking about really does affect what you do. The second premise is that cognitive activity can be monitored and it can be altered. So, and so here, what difference, a difference from the psychoanalytic people and even from the client-centered is you let the person tell you what the problem is. Now, in psychoanalysis, you know, you almost assume whatever they tell you the problem is probably isn't the problem. Or in client-centered often, you start off with the premise that the person may be telling you about a problem, but actually, as we talk longer, we're going to get to more profound issues. And so whatever is originally presented is probably not where we're going to end up. But in cognitive therapy, you start off with the idea that whatever the person tells you, that's what you're going to focus on. And then, since the person is telling you about a problem, you're going to try to find a way to alter it. And the difference here is that desired behavior change can be affected through cognitive change. Now, that's very different than what we've been talking about before, because we've talked before about people have to undergo emotional catharses, people have to undergo you know, a sense of experiencing different things interpersonally. And the cognitive behavioral people began saying, no, you can really initiate the change at the cognitive level. Now, a psychologist named Kasdan came along and he defined behavioral therapy, or cognitive behavior therapy, which he calls cognitive behavior modification. And he said it encompasses treatments that attempt to change overt behavior. So you're going to try to change the behavior of the person, but you're going to do it by altering thoughts, interpretations, assumptions, and strategies of responding. So this is now a big step away from the style that we had gotten from Skinner. It's also a big step away from what therapists had been doing with psychoanalysis and with client-centered therapy. And cognitive behavior therapy, which is often simply referred to as CBT, cognitive behavior, just CBT. It incorporates principles associated with information processing and learning theories. And a basic assumption of CBT is the recognition that there is a reciprocal relationship between clients' cognitive processes, that is, a relationship between what they think and their affect, that is, what they are really experiencing internally. And there is a relationship between their physiology and their behavior. And although cognitive, you know, behavioral therapy was really developed for individual disorders, the truth is these individual disorders really do differ in both their form and their application. And this system emphasizes the importance of changing the cognitions and the behaviors. And if you can change the way someone thinks, you will change their behavior. Of course, if you change their behavior, you'll either reduce or you'll get rid of their symptoms. And if you can get rid of their symptoms or lower their symptoms, then you're going to improve their level of functioning. So things are going to happen theoretically. They're going to happen faster in this system, and you aren't going to have as much information. Now, CBT really does clearly define roles for both the therapist and the client. And certainly, both of them are very active in this therapy. This is not where you come in and the therapist is going to just do something for you, but it's going to be a lot of interaction between the client and the therapist. The therapist assumes the role of educator, teaching the client about cognitive models that have been developed to understand the etiology of their problem. And more importantly, you try to teach the person about how they're maintaining their specific problems. So you try to help them to understand their own cognitions, that they are responsible for the kind of symptoms that they have. The clinician is also responsible for teaching clients the cognitive and behavioral techniques that are needed to alleviate their problems. So the client, in many ways here, is considered an expert on his or her own personal experiences, which might equate to his or her own problems. And then the client and the therapist work together to overcome the client's difficulties. As you can see, you know, in this system, especially in the beginning of treatment, the client is a much more responsible agent than the client that I have described to you in the other forms of treatment we've been talking about. You know, the client here is very active. Now, for clients to experience symptomatic relief, they must actively seek out new experiences. This, of course, can be scary. And they have to learn to look at the world in a new way. So the more rigid, of course, the symptom, the more frightened the patient, the more difficult it's going to be for somebody to look at the world in a new way. But in this theory, clients are taught over time to serve as their own therapists, to apply the principles that they've learned in CBT with decreasing amounts of guidance from the therapist. So you kind of teach a skill to people about how to assess things that aren't working, and then you try to teach them how to develop new cognitions that will allow them to look at problems in a way that they can deal with them. Now we're going to focus on the treatment of Aaron Beck. I think we don't have time to, you know, for a course in psychopathology, so I thought we would take one area, namely depression. Depression is a common problem that comes into all clinics, and Beck developed a model for how you treat depression. Now, a core assumption in his model is that people are active processors of information. Thus, an important role for the therapist is to help a person to get in touch with this information. What is it the person is telling himself or herself that's causing him to feel depressed? Now, in Beck's original cognitive model of depression, three important concepts were introduced to help explain the psychological underpinnings of the disorder. And these concepts have greatly informed our understanding, actually, of depression. First, Beck introduced what's called the cognitive triad. And he said that it was his contention that depressed people have negative views of themselves. I think we certainly see that in most depressed people. That their ongoing experiences, they also see negatively. And they're negative about their futures. Now, those things have been shown in all kinds of clinical practice. Almost anyone in clinical practice would agree with this, that the depressed person feels bad about themselves. The depressed person doesn't like what's going on in their life right now, and they don't like what's going on in their future. It was interesting finding, you know, clinically in gerontology patients, if you have a very depressed older person, one of the things that we have learned is if the person is suicidal, one of the indicators about how serious the suicidal ideation is if the person can't talk about the future. In other words, if you have an elderly person, they're very depressed, and you ask them about the future, and they can tell you, you know, like, what are you looking forward to? Nothing. What do you think is going to happen in the next year? Nothing. The odds go up dramatically this person is actually going to take their life. That is, we're not only talking about depression in this person, we're talking about real suicidal ideation. On the other hand, if the person looks to the future, and they see it as bleak, and they don't have a lot of enthusiasm for the future, but they see a future. That degree of difference is the degree of difference often between whether someone is really acutely likely to be suicidal or whether that's just a consideration, but they haven't reached the point where they're going to do something like that. Now, the second core component of Beck's model is called schema. Let's see, a scheme. And each day, humans are barraged with numerous stimuli from the environment. And he recognized it would be impossible to attend to every stimuli that comes to you. He also pointed out that once a person actually attends to a stimulus, how he or she comes to understand and process it might be very different from how another individual might react to the very same stimulus. So Beck suggested that our reactions to stimuli are determined by relatively stable cognitive structures, and so he called these structures schema. And he defined schema as an enduring and stable belief system that assists in explaining experiences, mediating perception, and guiding response. So if you think about this now, you know, the schema that you have is very important. It's really how you experience the world, how you understand it, and how you think about it. So then he said, once activated, schemas can have effects reaching far beyond the immediate situation. For example, you know, a relationship breaks up for a person, and this might trigger a depressive schema. And now, for some people, the schema that's developed could relate to the inevitability of the loss of all good things. Like, the relationship breaks up, and the person's thought is, all good things end for me. I mean, things don't work for me. I knew this relationship wouldn't work. Now, you can imagine, if you think about it, if that's the attitude someone has, probably the relationship won't work. Because from the beginning, someone is anticipating, even though I like this person, even though this is good for me, even though maybe the other person is very giving, that we have an individual who thinks it can't last. So what Beck said is you got to get a person to develop a new view, a view that is unrelated to similar events in the past. So the fact that past relationships haven't worked, if you want to help this person to get into a new relationship that's going to work, then you've got to get them to start thinking about how the relationship can work, and they have to move away from this cognition, the relationship's never worked for me. And it's interesting, too, you know, in some more serious troubled people, this cognition, like that things don't work, really gets broad. One example is that, you know, for some people, like, let's say an important piece of mail gets lost. And there are people who interpret that as no one cares for me. I mean, people don't care enough just to deliver my mail. It becomes a very personalized life experience. Most of the rest of us say, that's typical of the mail. Mail gets lost, and who knows where it got lost. But it doesn't become personalized. But if your cognition about this is that everything that goes wrong was kind of intended, and it was intended to slight you, then you become very depressed. And what Beck would say is this every event activates a schema in which you anticipate all these bad things. And if you look at the item I just mentioned, for instance, that, you know, some mail didn't get delivered, I mean, it would have been very easy to have a different anticipation to say, you know, that most people don't get their mail. Mail doesn't work terrifically well. You could come up with all kinds of things. Or you could just come up with the fact that, you know, this was an idiosyncratic event, and I'm not going to get concerned about it. I'll get somebody to send this to me again. But when you have a sense that this is one more example of how life doesn't work for me, then there's a problem. Now, Beck also introduced the idea of faulty information processing. And specifically, he thought that depressed people tend to erroneously think in extreme, negative, categorical, absolute, and judgmental fashions. If you think that way, it's not surprising that you'll develop a lot of negative affect. And so Beck said, these thinking areas maintain the client's negative beliefs about himself. And of course, if you think that way about yourself, then you also think negatively about your experiences, and you think negatively about the future, even when there's contradictory evidence. And that's the thing that's so difficult for people, that we might you know, think of as disturbed, that even when someone is being good to them, what Beck would say is this schema that they've developed will cause them to interpret that either the person is not being good to them, or that even if I acknowledge that maybe somebody's being good to me, it won't last. It will change. And so these are the cognitions that become very important. So then if you give that there's negative affect and behaviors, and that they're facilitated and they're maintained by faulty information processing, it makes sense that the main goal of cognitive behavior therapy is to fix errors in thinking. And in Beck's scheme, by the way, he also noted that sometimes you can change behavior first, and the change in behavior will cause the person's feelings to change. It's interesting because in other systems, you know, you kind of go in the opposite direction. That is, you try to get the person to change the way they feel about something, and then you assume they will behave differently. Beck thought, you know, in some cases, if you can just get somebody to behave differently, to walk into a job and interview, and to try to present themselves very positively, and they, you know, and this is a realistic job they should be seeking, and they go in, they present themselves well, and they get the job, that all of that may lead them to start thinking much more positively about themselves. That is, they behaviorally accomplished something important. And that may alleviate a lot of the depression they've had about not being successful, not being able to do anything well, not being very functional. That's a very new way, when it was first presented, of thinking about this. And it wasn't at all the way the clinical world was operating. Now, another variable for Beck was he thought, you really do have to make people aware of kind of their automatic negative thoughts. And by this he meant that individuals develop cognitions that cause them to think negatively without even considering what's happened. You know, for example, a person who always anticipates rejection may have called and asked somebody to go to the ball game or something with them. The phone rings, and they have caller ID. They see it's the person that they were calling to ask to go to the ball game with them. What do you think they think before they pick up the phone? Yeah, great, yes. It hasn't even happened yet. I mean, they're offering a chance for someone to go, might be to a good game. But because of their cognitive set, they see this person is calling. Their first thought is, he or she is calling to say they can't go. And that's the kind of thing that Beck says, when that's how you live your life, that is, you always anticipate negative consequences, then you've really got a problem. And so, you know, he thought that the first step in treatment is to help clients to become more aware of these thoughts. And so he taught people to become self-monitoring. And in line with the cognitive triad that we've been talking about, important targets then of the beliefs that Beck would look at in CBT were the expectancies one has about oneself, one has about the future, and what one thinks about the world and what's really going to happen to someone in it. Now, we'll take up from here in our next lecture, and we'll move on with cognitive behavioral therapy.